You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Today I'm talking to Mark Steele, a brilliant political comedian and not just a political one, but an excellent comedian who was there at the beginning in the 80s, the birth of alternative comedy. He was there and has been working hard ever since. He did a fabulous show at Edinburgh this year about a genuinely startling discovery in his own family tree. And he's also won Columnist of the Year last year, 2015. So he has got absolutely bundles to say. I'm going to let him say it. Recorded live at Black Medicine in Edinburgh as part of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival last year. Under the auspices of the PBH Free Fringe, this is Mr. Mark Steele.
Thank you. Now, we've got to try this, haven't we?
What was that?
With this, we were just the peculiar mic.
Yes. Yeah, no, yeah. You're doing fine.
Okay, good.
Is that all right? Is that stool all right?
I've not yeah, really... yeah, the stool's right. And this is right, I think.
Ladies and gentlemen.
It's day 406 in the Edinburgh Festival.
Yeah.
And some of the performers have started to eat members of the audience.
How are you in these final days? Are you coping?
Oh, you no, no one's coping. I'm given that comics are mental to start with. That it's then it's really quite deranged and peculiar, and it's sort of and it's quite odd to just sort of wander up the road. It's like a dream where you're all in some like all the comics live in some great big comedy house, and you sort of wander up the road and say, "Oh, there's Stuart Lee," and it is like a sort of you know dream, and you think, "Oh, I suspect Joe Pasquale is doing the washing up at the moment."
It's particularly noticeable in the children's play park on the Meadows, where any comedian who has young children, which is a lot of comedians, slice of the data at any given time, when comics are trying to avoid each other. And
it's just because my flat is beautifully close to here and to with all stuff's going on there. And there was an odd thing today where I was writing my newspaper column for tomorrow. Then I had to take a break from that to pop out over the... Right, I'm not complaining about this at all. I'm just saying this is just odd. I had to pop out from that to go about 100 yards across the way to do a show with Freddie Flintoff.
I saw this on your Twitter feed.
And then I saw Freddie Flintoff, which, as a sports fanatic, that is just sort of... I could hardly contain myself. And then come back... His daughter's in there. Was it all right, Freddie Flintoff? Yeah, just like an odd dream. That is a very odd thing to do. I'm just popping out to do a show with Freddie Flintoff. I'll be back. And it's like that every night. Normally, you do a show, you drive off somewhere and you go, oh, I'll see you tomorrow to the family, whatever. But I can pop out, I can put a pie in the oven, go out, do my show, come back, and it's just about ready. It's really, it's very, very peculiar.
You've not been to the Fringe for a while.
Well, I haven't done the whole 3-4 weeks, whatever it is. No, but I've usually come up here for some reason. Yeah, there's usually some reason.
And this show for you this year is quite different to the output for which people think of you. You're most widely thought of as a political comic in a
yeah, but that gets on me nerves because it's because that's not true. But there's nothing you do about it, I suppose.
Well, you've just won Columnist of the Year 2015 for a funny political column.
Yeah,
is it reasonable to call you a political comic?
Well, I think, well, first of all, I think both on the both words put together are wrong, because every comic is political. They might not know it, just as every person is political. The person that says, oh, I haven't got a political thought, is still political, because they still might go, oh, the bloody immigrants coming over here, how many more of them we have? Bloody need to send them back. They'll have those thoughts that are very political, or they might think, bloody bangers, it's a disgrace. You know, they haven't got any money for the local school. My kids had to go without his notebooks. But they, so, which of course are political thoughts, so I think the political bit of that is wrong. But also the comic bit, I like, you know, most of the stuff I do depends on doing a stupid voice or something. And I just sort of think, I just enjoy the whole thing of doing a show just like any other comic. I don't think I'm really very different from, I think it would just sort of, if someone thinks, oh, he's a political comic, they're going to be disappointed. If they come along and think, oh, well, that's strange. I was hoping to get his sort of take on the Liberal Democrat policy on agriculture. That's
But is anyone doing that? Are any comics that political? Because I feel like you are one of the most political comics in a very small group of comics.
Yeah, but I think all that... See, Frankie Boyle is intensely political because all his stuff is born of a rage. You know, much more than me, he's got a rage inside him, which is brilliant. I think he's brilliant. And I think that loads of, you know, so someone like that, he wouldn't be called a political comic, but he is. And then he's in a fury, isn't he, about
absolutely
all manner of things. And sometimes his fury takes him to all sorts of peculiar places. Like, he's so angry about everything, he just goes, I'm going to say the most shocking thing that I possibly can. There you are, up your arse, the Pope, fuck you up the fucking whatnot. And, you know, he's a little bit more adept at it than I am. And,
But he's
even Frank, up your ass, you fucking whatnot, shit, pope, fucking nun. That Frankie Boyle had a really, really unproductive day. But then even if you sort of get down, I don't know, I'm trying to think of the comics I've seen. Obviously, you know, someone like Mark Thomas, he's doing a show that I saw there, which is brilliant, as his shows always are, and it's about the way that land is now sold. So all the sort of land that you think of as being, oh, that's land that we all own, now you suddenly find it isn't. The bank has bought it or whatever. And he makes that brilliantly funny, and he does his daft little protests outside it and stuff, and it's marvellous. So that, you go, all right, yeah, that's political. But then there's lots of, there's loads and loads of people that you would, I'm trying to think of an example now. But
in terms of comics that would be invited to speak at a rally...
Oh, right. Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm sorry, I feel like I'm trying to convince you that you're political. Yeah, okay, you clearly said you don't think you are. Or a political comic.
Well, a political comic.
Which other comics do you bump into when you're speaking at rallies?
Well, Shappy, see, she speaks at rallies and she gets all sort of nervous and goes, oh, I don't really understand it. But in a way, that's the sort of product of this idea that politics is something that you have to be, you have to almost have an education in to be genuinely political. And you know, I saw Shappy speak to, I don't know, 100,000 people, and it was just like, I'm sick of this can't be right, and Jeremy Corbyn's here and he's a good bloke, and why are they having a go at him? And it was brilliant because it just articulated probably what so many people that have created the sort of little movement around Jeremy Corbyn, she articulated that. And then did it with a three-year-old kid on the stage with her as well, which is a great comics trick to win over the audience. Who's going to have a go at you then? But, you know, I think Shappy's brilliantly political. You wouldn't think of her as so.
I think what you've isolated there is that sense, that idea that people, that comics, a lot of comics, feel like they can't be political because they don't necessarily have the research. They haven't done the reading. And for someone like you who can appear on Question Time and hold your own against politicians who are very well practiced at arguing on telly, I look at something like that and I think, well, I don't have the argumentative skills and I haven't done the reading.
No, but I think that. I mean, I'm sat there and then I've done Question Time a few times and you're sat there with, who was I with? David Willetts, is that his name? David Willetts, right? Twice I've been on it with him. He's conservative something for something. And, and Liz Kendall. Liz Kendall, she was on it last time I was on Question Time. So there was, and, oh, someone else, some liberal who's probably lost his seat. So we were all sort of sat there, and then it sort of drones on into that official political ease, you know. So someone starts talking about, I don't know, the latest bill to reduce something by something. And they make it so dull and uninteresting and completely apart from normal people's lives and 2% of the GDP on this or that and that. And I drift off just like everybody else does. And then Dimbleby goes, Mark Steele, what are your thoughts on this? And my instinct is to go, I don't fucking know. Ask him, he's in the bloody cabinet. But you sort of, you know, you have to try and get over that somehow and sort of, and then remember that if you just, the simple things are the right things. You know, I don't know exactly what figures you're making up here, but I do know that the banks crashed. That wasn't the fault of the people who were being asked to pay for that banking crash. The swimming pool in the local area is shut down. As far as I'm aware, I'm not an economist, the banking crash was not caused by people swimming too much in the local swimming pool, the dirty bastards, bloody bringing down the currency rates with their fucking aggressive butterfly. So, those, why are those people having to pay? And you know that the people who did cause it, their bonuses have gone up. They can't even bring themselves to say sorry. That's it. And then if you've got that, then you just know this is bullshit. You know, these other people are talking. You're a Tory. You're defending it. You're talking bullshit. You're equivocating about it. If you said to him, that's wrong, then you would get a round of applause and people might vote for you instead of just going, I know it is a bit awful and we might think about doing something. I don't. And Liz Kendall was on this programme, was on Question Time, and she hardly said a thing. She sort of sat there and just said nothing, really. The following week, loads of people said, oh, what was that? Who was that woman who was on? No one could remember her. The next time, but then they give you a car in Question Time and you go back in the car and it was Newcastle. So you think, well, this is a little perk. You don't really get paid for it, but you get a nice little car, drive all the way back from Newcastle to London, and Liz Kendall's South London like me. And she said, here, should we get a bottle of wine for the car back? And I thought, yeah, it's all right. And we got a bottle of wine, stopped at a little shop there, a little corner shop. And she was quite a laugh. Not a political thought in her head about anything particularly. I sort of asked her a couple of times, and she sort of went, oh, God, you and your bloody politics, you know. But well, if I'm going to know about that, all I am is an MP. And I thought, she was going out living with, I believe, Greg Davis. The comic.
Yes.
Very funny actor, you know, in between us and all that. And I thought, oh, yeah, quite a nice woman, a bit hopeless. Next thing I know, she's standing to be the Labour leader. And I thought, what? What are you doing that for? No, you haven't got a clue. And then I don't suppose I'll be travelling in a car with her again now, because I've read sometimes they write the column for you. At the start of all this, she was asked, I swear this was the exact words, the interviewer, Andrew Neil, I believe, said, are you going to oppose the Conservatives, in the budget, the Conservative plan to cut welfare? And she said, I think the economy is really important. So it really struck a chord with me. Because most people go around going, the economy, don't give a shit. And that was her answer. And she kept coming out with things. She hasn't got a clue. I feel quite sorry for her, really.
Do you think, well, there's two things there. I want to ask about the post-show, the kind of the green room atmosphere after doing something like Question Time. I mean, you sort of told us there in terms of that one person. But is it a case where the politicians are professionally argumentative and then they go backstage and they're like, oh, yeah, how was that? You know, and they're much more chatty. And if they are, how do you fit into that?
Well, I'd like to answer that by making these two points.
We'll come to that type of answer next.
I'm very glad you answered the question, but I am not going to be drawn at this stage on the precise nature of the post Question Time green room chat. That is something that you'll have to ask Mr. Miliband. The time that I did Question Time that was most tricky, really. I just happened to be on. It was in 2003, and it happened to be, there was no way anyone could have planned this, the day when the Americans arrived in Baghdad and pulled the statue of Saddam over. That very night, there was Question Time was on, and I was on that. And that was pretty much the most nerve-wracking thing I've ever done. Because I did think, God, this is there's millions of people going to be watching this and it's all going to be charred. It's not like a sort of week where it's just about some court case or other. And I thought, Jesus, what am I going to do? And I thought, anyone who's been against the war is going to be, right, I'm their, you know, it's a bit like being a footballer or something. I'm for them, you know, tonight. And so I was just concentrating. I was just sort of going to, I thought, right, think through about three little sort of 40-second things and just say that, right, that get that to start with and then respond to what other people are saying. So I was just sort of running through what just like you would with a gig, really, you know. Yeah. You sort of think, right, just, you know, if you're doing a new bit, right, remember what I'm going to say here. And David Willetts, this is the first time I met him, he was sat just here, Tory, obviously not in the government at the time, and he leant across and said, you're a little bit nervous, don't need to be nervous, don't worry. I said, no, I'm all right. He said, oh, no, don't you worry about it. He said, once you get started, it'll just fly by. You just get stuck in and it'll just steam on by. You'll be gone before you know it. And I thought, well, thank you for the bloody tip, you know. So then it all starts, and of course it goes wild and it's charged because this bloody statue's only come down 2 hours before. It's been on the news all night. It's all anyone's talking about. And this great big row. There's a guy called Mike O'Brien, I remember. He was Home Office, I don't know what he was, but he was in the cabinet. He'd been Labour cabinet and he'd been one of the people who'd been supporting the war, justifying it. And I remember at one point, what was it? He said at one point, I thought, oh yeah, I've got you there, because he said, I think one of the reasons that that Saddam hasn't behaved in a worse way is because of the sanctions that we were putting on them, something of that nature. And I said, really? I said, what, you thought? So he was, you think Saddam was saying, oh, well, we'd, oh, no, do you know what? I've cut that bit, I've fucked this up. Right. Look, I'll give you some money. Don't ever, I'll fuck this up. That's terrible. No, a comic fucking making a joke, that'd be terrible. That'd be terrible. No, it's like, oh, an Englishman and a Scot. I forgot about the parrot. No, it's like, I forgot to tell you, there was a parrot and the nun, oh, the, like, anyway, whatever it was, it all sort of got quite outrageous. And then this this David Willetts, I was having a go at the Labour bloke, obviously, you know, saying that we were saying what a marvellous thing it was that they attacked Saddam and so on. And these people had been, they'd all been trading with him. And David Willetts sat next to me and he was sniggering. Yes, yes, he said, yes. And I was having a go. And I thought, you bastard, I said, you lot sold him the bloody weapons. What right have you got to sit there sniggering? And he went bright red. And I did. I thought, you little fuckers. So, fucking sniggering. You sold Saddam these bloody weapons. He's outrageous, these politicians. So it was all quite fiery. And at the end of it, I thought, oh, well, there'll be no more bonhomie from Mr. Willetts. And as the bloke comes around to unclip me radio mic, as he was doing it, this bloke Willetts leant over and he said, see, I told you you'd get jolly well stuck in. I bet that's marvellous now. Jesus. You did ever so well. I said, what? I said, I've just called you a bloody outrageous Tory bloody arms dealer in front of millions of people. I swear his exact words. He said, yes, that's the spirit. And now, I got up and the pair of us sort of walked off and he said, well, I think we jolly well deserve a drink after all that hard work. So I said, well, yeah. And we went into this back room, just me and him there, and he said, oh, marvellous. And there was this sort of one of those things you have at a barbecue, you know, one of those things with that keeps all the beer cold, you know, loads of bottles of beer in there, bottles of Bex and things. And I said, well, all right, here you are. And I got mine and I couldn't find a bottle opener. And I'm looking around for a bottle opener. And conservative shadow cabinet David Willetts, looked like the most boring person ever. He did that thing where he just went up to the corner like that, went, kish, and knocked his thing up. And I was sort of going, with my teeth, I couldn't do it at all. He said, oh, give it here, mugging about. There we go. Boom, there you go. Get that down, yeah. And I did actually say to him, look, mate, don't ever let this get out, that because if it gets out that I've had to rely on a conservative shadow cabinet member to open me bottle of beer, I'm fucked. And I, yeah, so I can see the problem. Yeah.
Does that make you despair somehow, that they just regard it as a game?
Yeah, of course. But I think, in a way, that's why you have to sort of avoid it, isn't it? I think if you did that all the time, once is fine. if you did that all the time, you'd get to know his neighbour's name, you'd get to know his kid's birthday, and then you're stuffed, you know.
You can't lay into him as much as you want.
No, you wouldn't,
because
you'd think, oh, yeah, I know him and he's all right, yeah. You would.
So this is Mark. I will try, as I always do, to keep this interruption as quick as possible, because I remember this conversation as being absolutely fascinating. Mark is so warm and wise and just has the ability to turn anger into comedy, to turn genuine sort of political thought, genuine awareness, to actually do the reading, understand what's going on in the world, take a position on it, and then, crucially, to make it really funny. So we'll get straight back to Mark in a second. I, of course, am going to advertise my tour to you. Now that the Izzy Sutty Show is done and dusted, thank you very much to everyone that came to that. There are, of course, Romesh Ranganathan and Dave Gorman coming up soon at Soho. But for now, let's focus on the tour. Thank you to all of you who've been in touch about being members of the Cavalry for me. Remember, you could join in that as well if you're coming to any of my touring venues. Sorry, if you live in any of the towns to which I'm touring, then you can email me, info@comedianscomedian.com, with Cavalry in the subject line. I'm just going to briefly keep banging on about this because it seems to be working. Someone, a lovely lady called Tracy, has taken it upon herself to sell out my Milton Keynes gig. So I'm sending her 10 posters. She's going to put them up in her place of work. And God only knows where she works, where she thinks she can get stuck into this. But if you are in any of the fascinating places I'm coming to, I don't have them in front of me. I'm tempted to see if I can do them all from memory, but that will almost certainly end in disaster. Shall I try? Here we go, genuinely without looking. Definitely Nottingham, Manchester, Birmingham, Bristol, Southend, definitely Sutton, that's at the very end. These are not in order, by the way. There's the Soho Theatre, of course, so maybe you live in some crazy Soho advertising tube and you'd like to to get your co-workers to come along. I'm also going to be in Milton Keynes in Wolverhampton. I'm going to be in Kingston. The show will also go to, I've said Manchester, haven't I? It was such a good start. Winchester? Is it? I don't know. I don't think I'm going to Winchester. Am I going to Windsor? I'm definitely going to Aldershot. I'm definitely going to, this is pointless, isn't it? Oh, I should have it in front of me. Shall I go and get it in the kitchen? No, I'll press on. Come on, Goldsmith, you can do it. Hemel Hempstead, definitely going there. Birmingham, I must have already said. Am I starting to go through the alphabet now? You do not. I mean, this is absolutely quintessential Goldsmith, isn't it? I think 3 minutes ago I said I'll keep this as brief as possible. I could literally just read out a list of them in front of me, but no, I choose instead to waste everybody's time with this absolute bullshit. I'm so sorry. If you're in one of those places and more besides, I mean, you can get all of them, as you know, from comedianscomedian.com/tour_2016. You can get all the info there. And if you're in one of those towns, email me with the subject line Cavalry. Send me your postal address. I'll chuck you some posters and you can convince your fabulous friends to come with you as well. Thank you to everyone who has clicked like or the new Facebook event button. Interested, which is nice because it means you're not hurting my feelings so much. You can go click, I'll click on this. Yeah, this event seems good. I want other people to know about it without committing yourself to going. And we all remember the days of Facebook events when they first started and 20 or 30 people would click going and then no one would turn up and they go, oh, not going, not in real life. No, I'm just sort of going to this. I've done it myself as well. So now we have this slightly suspicious interested button. But I believe if you click on that on any of the Facebook events for my tour, the show is called An Hour, then presumably it shows up in your feed. Does it? I don't know. And I think they change the rules all the time. Well, anyway, that's the marketing stuff done. Come and see the show on tour. And of course, if you hang around at the end of the show, you get to do the secret thing, which in this context refers specifically to hanging around after the final track is played at the end of the show. And we'll do a quick 5 or 10 minutes or as long as we can before we get kicked out of the venue. We'll do a little off the record Q&A. You can ask me anything you like about the podcast. So, that will be a lot of fun. I've got a crazy plan in the offing for a different sort of a live comedian's comedian show, a sort of an off the record extravaganza with maybe a couple of guests, maybe in a late night boozy kind of a way. don't have a title for it yet. If you can think of one, feel free to suggest one. Tweet me at ComComPod or email me or however you like to get in touch with me. Just write it in chalk on my back without me noticing. That would be fab too. That's all. That's the tour. Thanks for the donations. Keep them coming, of course. I really appreciate them. A couple of people have set up some monthly subscriptions. That's very kind of them. And we've had a couple of one-off donations last week as well. Those are very, very much appreciated. I am still working hard to make this show as interesting and far-ranging as possible. I have got a bunch of, I think what I've got, so 7 or 8 episodes in the can right now to eke out over the course of my impending transition to fatherhood. So I'm working hard. I'm working hard for you. And if you would like to reward me for that, if you would like to support the show or to signal to me that you're enjoying it, or that you're getting something out of it, it's making you feel more positive about this awful, awful business we call creativity, then can you tell I'm absolutely in the middle of... I've been trying to write my show in advance. This will make you laugh. We'll get straight on with it. I've been trying to write my show to get it finished for the Leicester Comedy Festival in February. Of course that's not going to happen. It's an hour and I've only been going 2 months. But I'm trying to. And in fact, here's a teaser. I'll tell you what's on my bit of paper at the moment that I did. I did a preview in Smoke and Mirrors in Bristol on Monday. It currently says Baby Jealous Shark Nest Primal Hypno Airbnb Castro Ring Bread Data Split Sacrifice Cafe Prevail Locusts City Kid Hero Coach Stallone Balloon. So, you know, you might be thinking, clearly, Stu, the work is done. So that's a little teaser of this forthcoming show. So when I say this awful business called creativity, what I mean, of course, is that I'm absolutely in the throes of desperately trying to get the bones of the show, to what's the expression, to break the back of the creative process for this year before the little baby he come. So I don't imagine I'm going to achieve it, but it feels good to have a sort of a fun deadline like that. As we always remember the Douglas Adams quote, I love deadlines. I love the whooshing sound they make as they go past. Now back to Mark.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Do you think that the way comics have to simplify ideas in order to make, or the way that you might simplify a political idea, like you were saying, in order to just go, this is, you know, I might not know about the numbers, but I know that it's not the people in the swimming pool who are responsible for this. Why should they suffer? That's kind of a simplification of the idea. Do you think that's similar to the way maybe politicians are thinking? You know, you said there's like the similarity of going, right, there's three things I've got to say. And when they go, you know, with that answer that she gave earlier on, saying, I think the economy is very important. Is there a parallel there between, like, in order to get...
That'd be a very bad comic, the equivalent of that, wouldn't it?
But you see what I mean? There seems to be a lot of parallels in terms of getting a message across where their goal is to, whatever it is, to get votes, and your goal is to get laughs. But both of you necessarily have to take a far simpler path than the actual issue might demand.
I suppose it is similar in a way. They've got a much thicker skin than we have, though, haven't they? I mean, if you do a show that goes badly, even not quite as well as you'd hoped, and that's awful. That is really, really awful. I mean, as often as not, after a show, if there's 300 people there, the comic who's done the show is probably the most miserable person in the room, probably, you know, and everyone else goes, hey, yeah, it's gone fine. But if it hasn't gone absolutely brilliantly fantastic and they've sort of hauled you through the street and made you king, you...
yeah, that's what... Like,
oh, fucking impressed and they made me king. Swindon again. And,
like Frank Skinner says, that's the danger when you're a comic. It's either... It just becomes binary. It's either brilliant or it's shit. And you've got to work quite hard mentally.
Yeah, well, I think Frank's very astute on that, actually. I've heard him... Yeah, and a number of those sorts of things, yeah. And but a politician, they get up and everyone's bored, stupid, and they must know that half the people, most of the people watching are going, what? I mean, how could you live with yourself if that was your performance? I think the economy is really important. How could you live with it? If a comic... Comics should be politicians. You'd go, oh, no, I went on the telly and my answer was, I think the economy is really important. No, it wasn't that bad. It was! Oh, no! Oh, well, don't, for Christ's sake, don't fucking show them the reviews. The economy is really important. One star.
When it comes to writing your column, when it comes to... I mean, how much crossover is there between your column and the ideas you're thinking about?
It hardly ever works. In a column, you can sort of get away with stuff a bit. Sometimes I've tried to do jokes from the column and I don't know, because it's about performance, isn't it? I think... You can't just read a bit out, I don't think. It's a completely different thing. Sometimes I had a thing I was doing about... I did have one thing, yeah, but even then it was sort of in a completely different way. Yeah, I did have a joke which was about... about the sort of immigrate, about why people vote for UKIP, because... Of course they do, because people are terrified, because they think every day you're told there's millions of Bulgarians, millions, a million Bulgarians can come at any point, any day, a million. So people are crapping themselves. They must be thinking, oh, one day I'll open the gate at the back. I can't get out, there's Bulgarians. As far as you can see, all in the garden, they're all there. And there'll be all these, but yes, we live here now. There's nothing you can do. Who's this here? This is Dimitrov. His head is stuck in cat flap. He live here now. Now, Lisbon Treaty, so you must feed every day with saucer of milk. And I thought, so I had this sort of that idea, which I did in a column, but, you know, if you wrote it out like that, it'd just be meaningless because it'd depend on everybody having to do a silly Bulgarian accent.
Yeah, okay.
As they're reading it. You know what I mean? So it wouldn't.
The starting points are the same, I suppose.
It's, but I think in a column, it just depends on people saying mad things. Like this thing with the people being, I've done one tonight for tomorrow's paper, and it's all these mad reasons. The whole idea of Labour absolutely hating the fact that 300,000 people have tried to join them. I find that hilarious.
Yes.
No! This is a disaster! People like us! It's your fault, Corbyn! We should go back to when everybody hated us.
And you've actually you tried to join.
Yeah, they wouldn't let you. Yeah, they wouldn't let me. Yeah, they said I didn't share the aims and values of the Labour Party. So, you know.
And is that...
I've been saying, I'm sorry, I've been busy. I didn't have time to invade Iraq. I do me best.
Do you envisage that they've got some sort of database on everyone, or is it just that your name's a red flag?
At first I thought, ooh, I'm important. I wish it was just that, but it's not. It's thousands of people, and you just sort of these stories all the time. It's just people who've stood as people who are councillors, people already in, like, all sorts of people. But they might have said, oh, I would vote Green if I was in Brighton, you know, where Caroline Lucas is the MP, something like that. That's enough to get struck off, you know, that sort of thing. Because they're going through people's Twitter accounts to see if they've said anything critical of Labour. I mean, that is quite staggering.
Do you know that?
No, they're admitting this now. They're saying that this is what they're doing. This is their way of being robust. We are going to weed out these people who are, they're saying, oh, Conservatives who are deliberately voting just to bugger the thing up. But it's not that. I mean, there's very few of those. But there are people who are sort of joining Labour because they think, well, if Jeremy Corbyn was the leader, then that would be a different thing. And so they're then being told that if you voted last time, even going through canvas returns, they're admitting this, they're going through the way, I don't quite know how this works, but people knock on the doors, don't they, and at election time, how are you going to vote?
Oh, and they keep a record.
And they keep a record. And if you... So, this is genius for a party that's lost an election to go, we do not want anyone who didn't vote for us last time. That's... And... Like, I've put this in the paper today. If every party did that, you'd never have to have another election. Yeah. The next, in 5 years' time, Dimbleby would just go, here's election night special, the results, well, they'll be the same as 5 years ago. And now the snooker.
Let's just stay on that idea for a second, that specific joke, because until you said the punchline of that idea, we were all at the same sort of level. We were all kind of going, that seems ridiculous. But you've got the ability, as an experienced comic, to just describe it in such a way to just take that idea and just turn it into a very quick picture that gets a big laugh out of everyone here.
All right.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Do you see what
Yeah, so I'm rather clever, aren't I?
Well, I'm really fascinated by what are the sort of... Are there any kind of guiding principles that you find yourself working with when you take an idea, when something annoys you and you go, there's a column in this, or something frustrates you and you think, I want to do some stand-up about this. What are the sort of principles that you use to kind of attack the stupid thing that's been said?
I think... Well, I think that there is something... There is something about just seeing the world in a funny way. And I think that there is an enormous amount written about trying to analyse that. But more and more, I'm sort of coming to the conclusion that there are people who see the world in a funny way, and then there are people who don't. And the people who don't, they get very frustrated. So if, for example, you know, you might sort of, like a comic, I'm trying to think of an example. Like I've got a joke that I've been doing about, these are all the political things, overtly political things we're talking about here, aren't they? But, for example, you might say, I've got a joke about the articles you get in newspapers saying that the benefits cheats, you know, there's all these benefit cheats. And the example I'll give is one where articles in papers say things like, well, there's a woman in a council estate in Newcastle, 135 kids she's got, every single one of them on benefits. Now they bought a giraffe and the giraffe's on benefits. And now they've written to the council and said that the giraffe's getting a crick neck because the ceiling's too low. So the council have put them all up in St Paul's Cathedral. And then one of the kids has got compulsive snooker syndrome. So the council have brought them around a full-size snooker table. But the mother says she can't count up the points because she's allergic the white gloves, so the mayor has to come out and be referee, otherwise he'll be put in jail by Europe. Right. So, but I think that I don't know if that, you know, a comic would sort of think of things like the giraffe or something, I suppose. But then you will get people who will say, oh, well, that's spoilt it, because you've got a very good point there and you just spoil it because no one has a giraffe. And it wouldn't fit in the flat. And they just, you know what I mean? You must get this. Yes. There are just people who just, you don't see them because it's part of our world. They don't come to the, sometimes they might come. I get people who will, on Twitter, you get this, and they will send me something, go, oh, I'm very disappointed in you, Mark, because that's not a very good point, or something like that. And they anger me more than any right winger. More. I think you pompous fuck. You just hate them. You know, just, oh, I'm very disappointed. You know what I mean? That sort of thing. Because they want you to make a political point that that they can agree with. They don't really see that anything is funny. And the left can be as guilty as that as the right quite easily. I mean, the right certainly are. The right will claim that the old political correctness, the left-wing comedians, you're not allowed to, all that sort of thing. But, of course, they are just as bad. They're the one. Like, there was a fuss, wasn't there, when Jimmy Carr made that joke, I think probably wasn't his joke, was it? But he made a joke about. No, it wasn't. It wasn't. I'm not being mean. He was open about it. It's not his joke. It was a soldier's joke when they say all these soldiers getting their limbs blown off in Afghanistan. Tragedy. Mind you, we'll have a bloody good Paralympics team next time.
Yes.
Now, that's what that was a joke he told. It's a really good joke. It's a joke soldiers would tell. Of course it is. And, of course, the Mail went nuts. How dare he denigrate? And, of course, the soldiers all go, well, of course you tell a joke like that. So they are quite as capable. But then on the left, there is that as well. You know?
Yes, OK.
And they go berserk and they just can't see that something is funny. And that's why I think there's this sort of predicament whereby there's these questions are asked. Can you make jokes about that? You must get there. Every comic gets this. It's really frustrating. This is a serious subject you're talking about. Isn't this really too serious a subject for comedy? And I think it's one of the most frustrating things you could be asked because it shows how low the status of comedy is, because you would never ask a similar thing of a playwright. You wouldn't say, but this the war in Iraq is a very serious subject. Sorry, it's too serious to just sort of denigrate with the frivolities of a play or a song or a poem. But comedy, it's just assumed, even after all the years we've had of Richard Pryor to Louis C.K. to all the brilliant comics talking about nothing but serious subjects, and they still assume that comedy is just, you know, what's red and sits in a corner, a naughty strawberry. And I just find that really, really frustrating. And also the fact that they don't sort of, the people who criticise comics in that way, they don't get that it's to do with context, isn't it? So when they will, if a joke is just put on a bit of paper, this is what this person said. Now, it's all to do with the context in which it is said. I've got a disabled mate, for example, talking to him tonight. He's got no legs and one arm. And every now and again, I'll go around, I'll wheel him up the pub, and quite possibly as I'm wheeling him up the pub, I'll go, you lazy fucker, every bloody time. Me with some people. I wish I had no bloody legs and got pushed about everywhere. And no one could possibly take offence at that because he knows I'm his mate and I've been for 30 years and so on.
Sure.
If you was to write that down, outrageous, still denigrates disabled people. Because, you know what I mean? And the show I do on the radio depends on me going round being absolutely brutal about a town I've been to. It's never, ever a problem because everyone, I hope, can see, oh, he really likes this place, really.
Yes.
They can see it in your eyes. And that's why you can do it anyway. I reckon you or I or any of the comics we know could go into a black club full of Jamaicans, take the piss out of Jamaicans and would go down fine. Because they see it in your eyes that you're on their side. Another comic who was racist would say exactly the same things and they'd go, no, he don't like us. And
yeah,
they turn
eyes. You've got to account for context. You've got to account, I guess, for the audience, for the context in which it's performed as well,
whereby the
audience will... You've got to trust people to make their own judgment on it.
Yeah,
but I suppose what you're talking about is when someone is definitely a comic. And do you think that there is sort of like... you know, Stuart Lee is fond of talking about the kind of the sacred space of clowning, that almost, you know, that kind of,
right,
you know, sacred relationship between, like, this is the comedy stage, I'm a comedian, this is what we've all bought into. And similarly, an oft-used defence of someone like Jimmy Carr or Frankie Boyle is that the audience have come there to see that. They know what it is. There's a contract between them.
I think if you bought a ticket to see Frankie Boyle and then went, oh, my God, I can't believe that he's mentioned that.
And you know what? I've noticed, particularly at this festival, I've noticed two or three different comics who are known for being towards the sort of the self-proclaimed edgier end of things, kind of making a preemptive strike on going, hey, and listen, if you're gonna be offended about this, then you obviously haven't Googled me. Have you seen that?
Several times they say...
This is a freelance man from the audience.
It's a bad bit coming up, or it's a dangerous bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Oh,
absolutely.
No.
Yeah, a couple of people flank you go, well, you know, you've obviously not that, which seems slightly to spoil the idea of the contract.
Go, aren't I on the edge?
Yeah, that's... yeah, exactly, yeah. There's sort of people who would call themselves edgy in their press releases.
Yeah.
I'm identifying a broad trope... And let's bear in mind that most press releases are often written by PRs, not the acts themselves. I hope people who call themselves edgy are still prepared to come on my show. Is that disclaimed enough for you?
I know, this is, well, I get it, because someone wrote about it or something. I don't read the reviews, but someone did say about my show, it was brave. on that, I just thought, oh, for Christ's sake, did you come on the night that I did it in a cage with a leopard then?
I want to talk about your show that you're doing at the moment. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was very brave. I really enjoyed it. I got a lot out of it. I think we'll talk about it in a second. I just want to stay with some of the ideas of the techniques, of the ways you attack a subject in order to find the funny in it. And I wonder if you ever recognise, given that the amount of writing, the amount of columns you do, the amount of stand-up you do you ever spot yourself doing the same sort of trope, doing the same sort of thing?
Yeah, in the sort of the radio series, because I've done 6 series of it now, and so it starts to get tricky because you go to people who don't know the show, I have to go to a town and just find out as much as I can about the town and then just be relentlessly rude about it and hope that they sort of, they go, oh, but he likes us really.
I listened to Basingstoke today and it was tremendous.
Oh, right. Basingstoke, yeah. Where with all the roundabouts, yeah. There was about the lamppost, wasn't it? Wasn't there someone? There was a whole discussion on a website about
the
lamppost. Yeah, no, wasn't it that the lampposts weren't as bright as they used to be?
Oh, yeah, the wattage.
They've changed the wattage from 80 to 60. I don't know why they've done that. You know, brilliant.
And
I don't think I was brilliant. They were brilliant. And they're funny themselves. That's people are funny themselves. I did one in Melton Mowbray in this last series. And Melton Mowbray, famous for pork pies. And people are obsessed with pork pies. And I went to see the bloke who's the head pork pie man at the Melton Mowbray pork pie shop. And he sat me and Cole Cooper, the producer, down and started lecturing. We said, we've only got 40 minutes. OK, and after 40 minutes, he'd got as far as the jelly. That's and then we said, mate, we've got to go. We'll give it another 5. We've got to go. We've got to be somewhere. And he said, well, I'm just starting on the pepper. I'm just starting on the pepper. You can't leave now. And this bloke was hilarious. And then I was so sort of impressed with the audience when I just mentioned, I said, today we went to see the pork pie man. And I couldn't help thinking at the one and the same time, Christ, this bloke is extraordinarily knowledgeable about pork pies, but at the same time thinking, oh, for Christ's sake, mate, it's only a pork bloody pie. There are other things in life. And it got this huge cheer that wasn't for me, but it was just clearly everyone had come across this bloke. This whole town had at some point, when they'd been at school or something, had to go and think, oh, no, we've got the pork pie blokes coming in to lecture us about pork pies. And what was the point I was making? Right, so
spotting the familiar.
Yeah. So something like, so in a way, I'm just sort of hoping that I come across things that are just naturally fun. And a comic does that. That's what a comic does, isn't it? You see the same thing as everyone else, but you think, oh, if I just tell that, people go, oh, yeah, that is funny. Other people might not have spotted it. You know?
Do you?
But right in the joke, sometimes I do think, oh, no, hang on, I think I did that with Beric.
I wondered about that, because there was something, particularly in that Basingstoke one, there was a way in which you were slagging them off whilst praising them not exactly praising them, but you were sort of saying, you were getting them cheering about the fact that they had no imagination. Do you know what I mean? Right. It was like, you're like this, you've got loads of roundabouts, you're really boring, but some of you still believe in yourselves. And I don't remember the exact jokes.
Oh, yeah, no, they did, because I met a bloke who was so... In Basingstoke, there was a guy who'd written a sort of little local history of it. Basingstoke was where the longest riot in British history took place, I recall now. It went on for 2 years, and the cause of it was the Salvation Army, because... The Salvation Army, when they were set up, I didn't know this till I did that programme. The Salvation Army were an army. That's why they were called an army.
Yeah.
They would physically go into pubs and drag people out to try and curb the swell of alcoholism in the 1880s, whenever it was set up. And they chose Basingstoke, which was deliberately chosen because it was known as a place of extraordinary alcoholism. And so this pitch battle took place, and this riot went on and off for 2 years. At one point, I think a third of the population of the town was involved in a mass brawl. And it's even mentioned in a Gilbert and Sullivan opera.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's references to it. Basingstoke, and you look at it now with its twee little roundabouts and its little shopping malls and think, oh, you had a bit of spark at one point, didn't you?
Do you often have to do that with your different towns? I've heard a couple of different episodes. You need to I mean, you're performing to an audience of those people in that place. So you must presumably be always walking a tightrope of needing to slag them off and wanting to for comic effect, yeah. And also not wanting to turn them all against you.
Well, I suppose in that one, an example, there was a guy who we met there, and he was the most enthusiastic person. He was all the time spoke like this, and the reason we met him was because he had broken the world record, I believe, for consistently rowing in a rowing machine. And he'd sat in the shopping centre for 8 hours a day without a day off for 18 months. And the amount of the mileage that had come up on the thing was equivalent to rowing round the world. And what an utterly pointless waste of 18 months. And But I introduced him, and he just got this enormous cheer. He was the most famous person in Bayside, because everyone said it. Was like, oh, there's a fucking idiot who rows all day. And everybody knew him, and you couldn't help but love him. He was so enthusiastic. And I said, for Christ's sake, you've done all of that rowing, and you haven't even got out of Basingstoke. But he was fine with it, and he was... Of course, because you can't. How can you not both admire and despair at someone like that at the same time?
There's something, it seems to be, peculiarly British about guy.
Yeah.
And the nature of your show is that you're looking, it's almost about Britishness.
Yeah, I think it probably is.
British towns. It strikes me, just thinking about it now, that there's something about you that has a similar sort of Britishness. Like, do you gig in other countries?
I've not done much.
It hard to imagine you in other countries because you seem so, for me, you seem so culturally intertwined with Britain.
Oh, right. Well, I'll take it as a compliment anyway, because I think it's... I think we're brilliant at laughing at ourselves. I think we are. I think if you were... I've done gigs in America. It's been all right, but I think this programme would really struggle in America because... I think if you went to Cincinnati, noticed a dozen peculiar things about Cincinnati and then did that, I think they'd go, well, what are you talking about? Isn't that what everyone does? You know, the equivalent, if there was a lamppost thing website there, they'd go, well, don't you think it matters what the wattage is and the lamppost? Whereas here, people are more likely to go, yeah, I suppose from the outside, that does look nuts, doesn't it? I don't know why.
Well, maybe it's more that we're parochials. We're much closer to other cities. We're much more like... We know more about the people near us. We know people more about the towns near us, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe. I don't know. Whatever it is, we're sort of used to... I don't know. We're more likely to slag ourselves off, aren't we? I mean, it's probably unfair. I'm sure you could go to Australia and do that as well.
Okay.
I don't know.
I want to talk a little bit about your show. Who do I think I am? Which is, I mean, I saw it very early on in the run, and every time I walk past your poster, there's more and more stars and reviews and splat. I mean, you've clearly had a fantastic festival.
Yeah.
Let's go a bit deeper into that.
I don't look like I'm showing off. Yeah,
no,
I suppose
you won't.
So.
You won't. This is the place to. It's fine. Or you know, no one thinks you're showing off. I'm asking you directly. How's it gone? Have you been?
Yeah,
were you expecting
really
it to go as well? Were you been surprised by it?
I'm blessed with a ridiculous story. I mean,
it is mental.
Yeah, it's hard to think of something more convenient if you want to bring a show up to Edinburgh, amongst other things, for people who haven't seen it. I tried to trace my natural mother over a period of years, not for any reasons of being particularly sort of torn in any way, or certainly not because I was trying to find myself or anything like that. As I say in the show, what was I going to find out? Turns out I'm a racist. Never knew. But because I thought I ought to sort of let her know I'm all right, I didn't think I would ever come across my natural father. That never occurred to me. As far as I knew, he was just some French bloke who'd got her up the stick one night in 1959. And then it turns out, having traced my natural mother... Someone else spoke to her. I'd never spoke to her. She didn't want to know. But she did, clearly to drop him in it, say, let me tell you who the father is. And the natural father turns out to be, amongst other things, the 1976 World Backgammon Champion. and a man who wasn't French at all, but an Egyptian Jew, that she must have lied back in the 1960s, and also is a multi-millionaire Wall Street trader, best friend of James Goldsmith and other unsavoury characters.
No relation.
Yes, no relation.
As far as I'm aware.
Yeah. Maybe
yeah,
he is.
Yeah, yeah, wait, although having seen your show, who knows?
I wouldn't have tried to put together yet another show about someone tracing their family and so on, unless it really was quite ridiculous. And there are, I mean, sometimes, I know people, you know, the phrase, oh, the show writes itself. It never does. But this one half did.
Yeah. But then there is something, for all you say, yeah, the subject material you're presented with and the fact of the real-life journey to find that out. You could do a lot of things with that. A lot of different comics could take a lot of different directions on that material. And something I think that I really enjoyed about your show was how incredibly unsentimental it is.
Oh, right, well, thanks. Yeah. No, that was... any attempt at sentimentality there has been really... swept away, yeah. I don't want it to be sentimental. I mean, I don't feel sentimental about it. I'm moved by the anguish of my natural mother because she was one of millions of victims of this absurd ideology that there was at the time, that we should all live in this natural family state, which was so natural that I don't think there's hardly one family that did live in that natural state. Mm. And though it just caused immense anguish, you know, for those, the most obvious one, of course, people who were gay having to pretend to themselves as well as to everybody else that they weren't because they thought they were wrong and wicked or evil or sinful or whatever. And in my mother's case, you know, having a baby and then having to just deny it to herself and everybody else and so on. So I do, you know, that I think is awful. But I don't want to say that in the show. That's, I think, evident. But it's funny. I mean, I think, and again, that comes to people who think things are funny and people who think they aren't. And I think that finding out my natural dad is a multimillionaire Wall Street trader, whatever else it is, it's funny. How can it not be? How can that not be
absolutely
funny?
Absolutely. Because, well, it's almost like you become... We love an underdog. In comedy, we love an underdog. You can't win, you have to lose. And there is something very funny about the fact that you, with your political history, your beliefs, your outspoken kind of, you know, anti-capitalist nature, would find that out. It's like the ultimate, oh, for fuck's sake. That's, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. The line I enjoy doing most, because it turns out he knew Tiny Rowlands and James Goldsmith, yeah, were his closest mates. And the line I like doing most is that when I found this out, I thought, oh, no, for years, since I was 18, I'd been screaming about how unfair society was, that there were these people at the top of society and they didn't deserve to be there and it wasn't right. And if you wanted to pick on particular individuals to prove your case, you would just jump on Tiny Rowlands and James Goldsmith. And now it seems that I was that close to spending my life not yelling about them, but calling them Uncle Jimmy and Uncle fucking Tiny.
And you say that's interesting. You say that's your favourite line in the show. What is it specifically about that that appeals to you?
I think it's the rhythm of Uncle Fucking Tiny. I wonder how many times those three words have been said together. Yeah, I don't know. There's something, but you know what it's like. I mean, that's why. I mean, to people who aren't comics, this is the nutty thing. You know, Stuart, there is those. Conversations you have, the one that goes, right, what's funniest in that joke, a walrus or a hippopotamus? A walrus. Walrus. Yeah, walrus. No, hippopotamus. Walrus gives the wrong, it's confusing. Hippopotamus. You know those conversations.
Yeah, absolutely.
That is a joke. And then you try it, and then the walrus don't work. And then you try it with hippopotamus, big laugh. Why? No one knows. I suppose there is a rational reason. It's a bit like, you know, there is a rational explanation for, I don't know, the end of the universe, but we don't know what it is. And similarly, I don't know what it is why certain jokes just work when you do it like that. Sometimes you just accidentally do it wrong and it gets a much bigger laugh. And you never find out why.
One of the most frustrating things I find in the creative process is you write what you think is a clever joke, and then on the way to it, you improvise part of the setup.
Yeah.
And then 10 gigs down the line, you have to drop the clever joke because it turns out the setup is way better. And you're like, oh, thanks, great. That's a great thing to see. But just to stay with this idea, when you write your stand-up, are you sitting writing it in the same way as you do your column? What does it look
bastard.
Like?
I think it's the hardest bloody thing. Harder than a... If I write my radio series, then I'll go to the town and I'll have a day in the town, and then there'll be something about the town that you think, oh, right, that's the sort of place it is. And a dozen people will have said something that you think, oh, that's quite funny. There's a thing here that they all say. There's a phrase. There's something.
Do you have to go looking for it, or do you just try and just have a normal day out?
A normal day out. And sometimes, this is what happens quite often, people, bless them, they misunderstand. All right, so you want to have a little look around. Actually, Berwick was one where this bloke said, right, now come down here, you'll love this, because if you see that church there, now look at that, you'll notice that the corner there is slightly different brickwork. That's because that wall collapsed in 1581, and of course, by the time it was rebuilt, it was a different architect. And I was going, mate, don't worry. Let's just wander around the town. No, but it's so vitally important. You know? And poor bloke, he just went on and on and on like this for a day. And I had to keep saying, the Baroque something or other, Georgian something, Gable of the whatnot, I'm not going to know any of that. But just the general wandering about, you just pick up on things. And then I make all my notes, and then it's sort of, I sit down and write it, you know, sit up at night and write it, usually with the sport on in the background, and that's how it gets written. Stand up, that's the hardest thing, don't you think?
Yeah.
I think it's the hardest, because you can't...
Yeah, no, it is, hence this show.
You can't sit down and just write it. Some comics do, maybe, but I don't think it works, because it's, especially if it's relying on little bits of acting and... You just have to do it, I think, and just see what works and try a silly voice or a, you know, it's stupid. That's the thing. When people go, oh, yes, because you're so political with what, and I think, oh, for fuck's sake. I just think, oh, there's a silly. I was one of my favourite little bits I did a few years ago. I was just thought someone, we were just talking about sort of putting, you know, you just put two different things that shouldn't go together. And I said, yeah, I don't know, like you might just, I was at a party saying, yeah, you might just go Rastafarian weatherman. And then I thought the next day, I thought, oh, that is quite funny. And I did this thing and I found out exactly how it goes now. First, let me tell you about a massive rain that will cascade down from them heaven, sent in by the King of Kings, Jah Rastafari, moving slowly from the West Midland across, causing scattered shower and ras glad me moving, or something like that. You can get the sort of idea. And it's just sort of, I don't know, what goes together, I don't know.
But it's interesting because you, I think, you've demonstrated already tonight, you have the experience, you've got the understanding of the rhythm, you've got the understanding of which word is funniest. In that more, like, I find it hard to believe in any of your, like, the conversational funny that you've produced tonight. You know, that's an odd way of saying it. You've been funny tonight, and in a way that you haven't written. Do you see what I mean? And I find it hard to believe that there's been any kind of... Like, what's the equivalent in your brain when you're kind of ad-libbing? The equivalent of going, is it a hippo or is it a walrus? What's that about? Is that just born of experience?
It's probably not anything else. It's probably, you know, like, just like yourself or any one of the sort of, you know, the good comics that are up here, and there's a great many of them. And when your sort of mind's working properly, you're sort of putting two different things that don't go together. Here's an example. My son, who is now doing stand-up up here, he's 19 and he's doing well. And just because he'd been around the sort of comedy world for a while already, when he was about 12, I'd say, my wife come back from somewhere or other. She said to me, my lad wasn't in the room, she said to me, my friend today rang up and her car's broken down on the A23 somewhere, and she's had to call the RSC out to come and fix it. And what you do as a comic, you can't help it, right? You've got two things there that don't go together and you put them together, and I've automatically had to go, oh, did they come out and go, ah, oh, yonder gasket indeed, methinks that oil doth spurteth forth and render this carburetor obsolete, methinks, and so on and so forth, right? Yeah. And of course, this is what happens in families. Instead of going, oh, yes, aren't you funny? Oh, fucking of course. Oh, you know I meant the RAC.
Yes.
And I said, right, when Elliot comes in, my son Elliot, I said, just say exactly the same thing and see what happens. And she said, oh, yeah, I was just saying, my friend broke down the A23, had to call the RSC out. And immediately he went, the RSC for a car? Did they go, ah, me must put the bonnet up, methinks forsooth, yonder, and so on. And, of course, because he's used to sort of tying these things together. You know, other people who aren't comics are doing things more productive with their lives. But I think the quicker you do it, it's a process that most people know. I think if a comic, you're doing it all the time and you do it quicker. It's just the same as, you know, I play cricket and I'm shit at it. I sort of know what you're supposed to do, but I can't do it. But I can because I play a bit, I can see a good cricketer, a ball that's come down at 90 mile an hour swinging and they still managed to clout it for four. And I could sort of see how, I could understand the process, but I could never in a billion years emulate what they're doing. But you can sort of see the process of it. And I think it's not that much of a genius thing what comics do. You just do it quicker because you're used to doing
it. So is it talent, or is it predominantly talent, or is it predominantly skill?
Madness. It's predominantly madness and ego, isn't it? Comics are terrible people. I mean, I love being with comics, but they're terrible people.
Yeah.
If a comic dies, 50 other comics will be at the funeral, every one of them thinking, I hope my speech gets the biggest laugh. Yeah. We are terrible people.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've probably got time for one question. Why do you think, is this gentleman's question, there are no, and I think there are a few, why do you think there are no overtly white right-wing comics?
I don't know really why, but there were, of course. I mean, Jim Davidson was overtly right-wing. I mean, he wasn't just someone who was on the right and he was a comic. He was overtly right-wing. You see some of the stuff that he was doing about how he hated immigrants and so on. There was no... See, he wasn't funny about it. He would just go into a rant. But they seem to be sort of... I suppose there are those people. I bet there are those people. You probably wouldn't get them up here. You'd get them in little corners, wouldn't you, of the sort of society where you know, I don't think they're going to come up to the Edinburgh Festival with it. I don't know the answer, though,
Jeff Norcott is a comedian who's an excellent comedian, a friend of mine, friend of the show, and he's a Tory. And that there are very few others.
But does he do stuff that is overtly Tory?
Or
is he just a Tory and he's a comic? That might
be the issue. I mean, No, that's the issue. What I mean is I don't know if he does fulfil that criteria. I don't know that he does.
Frank Skinner is very Christian, isn't he?
Yes.
But I don't know, does he do stuff about that in his act, for example? I don't know. I mean, he possibly does. Does he? It's one thing to be sort of, to have an ideology and be a comic, but to do that stuff together... Yeah.
You see very few benefit nights for the Conservative Party with a bunch of Tory comics doing Tory political stuff.
No. McIntyre has done stuff, hasn't he, for Conservatives. Okay. But, again, he wouldn't...
It'd just be a gig to him, would it?
It would, yeah, possibly. But he wouldn't go out and sort of do a load of stuff saying, you know, why we should... privatised Royal Mail.
It must be hard to sell. I think, I mean, surely the reason behind it is that comedy is about sort of punching, it has to be punching upwards, don't you? That's what people say, you've got to punch up, you can't punch down. And the nature, I would say, as a broadly left-wing person, is that that's the right way round. You know, if you're a left-wing person, you can speak truth to power. There's no point speaking truth to people less powerful than yourself.
Yeah, well, Charlie Chaplin wrote about this. So, you know, Charlie Chaplin wrote about this at some length, and he said if a woman was describing a scene where someone's ice cream on a balcony fell off and it went down the back of someone, and the person it went down the back of in the film, it had to be a posh person. It had to be. That was funny. If it had been a poor person, that'd be an entirely different thing. It would be a bullying thing, laughing down at someone. Ha, ha, ha. You know, look, we're better than you. But laughing up at someone. I suppose that's true. But then also, because we've been in right-wing times, haven't we? And so to kick against authority, you have to be on the left in a way, because we've been in a you know, maybe if Jeremy Corbyn became Prime Minister, then that would probably change. You'd have to take the piss out of him from the right, perhaps. I don't know.
That feels like not necessarily a downhearted ending, but but while I'm certainly the vision of a Corbyn Prime Minister, I don't mean it's downhearted necessarily, but let's just finish up with my favourite current final question. What would you can interpret this any way you like. What would you have written on your comedy gravestone?
Oh, God, no. God, I've not got to think of that already, have I?
I'm asking everyone, no matter of regardless of their age. But your final message to comedy.
I'd much rather people... I'd say what I would hate would be some po-faced fucking lefty writing some twaddle about, oh, blimey, well, he exposed something or other and made us... and was. Oh, that would just be absolutely awful. That would be just fucking awful. I'd much rather... someone just go, oh, well, made a laugh, did some silly voices. I don't know.
Political comedian,
yeah. Please, anyone in this room, if you're here after me and you see my gravestone and it says political comedian on it, you have my permission. In fact, I'd say it is your duty to get a chisel and knock out the political.
Thank you. That's a brilliant answer. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Mr. Mark Steele.
Thank you.
So that was Mark Steele. Thank you so much to Mark for coming on the show. Do catch that show if he's touring it. You can find him online, I'm sure, and on Twitter. He's very funny on Twitter. And I ran out of steam there because I was trying to work out whether I had in fact seen him on Twitter or whether you're going to be listening to this going, well, Stuart's doing this on autopilot because he's not on Twitter. I think he is. I think Mark Steele is on Twitter. I feel like I can see it at Mr. Mark Steele. Am I making that up? Better check before you tweet abuse at him or indeed myself. But try and catch up with him. The show really was fantastic, and I'm sure it'll be going to places beyond Edinburgh as well. So that's that. Next week, Jenna Friedman, absolutely brilliant, did a show called set your ears to swearing now, doing a show at Edinburgh called American Cunt. I mean, that's a statement. So that was a really exciting experience, that show. Very, very funny. And she is dry. My God, she's dry as sand. So that will be the last of the Edinburgh shows we've recorded last year when that one comes out. I'm sort of planning for this Edinburgh. I think I might not do a run of live shows this year. I think I might get people round wherever I'm staying in Edinburgh and sort of take all of the admin out of the process and just have the conversations. But we'll see. Maybe I'll do one. Maybe I'll do like a special secret hit and run one. Yeah. Yeah, but more info from here to come. And then who are we doing? Seymour Mace later this week, interviewing Seymour Mace. Still got Hari Kondabolu to come out. We've got Abigailia. We've got Uncle Mike Wilmot and plenty more besides. Who else? Tanya Edwards. Oh, my God. I had a brilliant conversation with Tanya Edwards. That's coming out shortly also. So that's it for now. You can leave now. You can turn this off. I just for those of you who stayed, here's a thing. should I be grouping you into categories? I never know whether you listen to these bits thinking, holy God, what's he talking about? Or whether you're thinking, God, not this again, get on with the interview. as I'm sure some of you are, and that's perfectly reasonable. You know, I can't honestly say I listen to every second of every podcast I listen to. I am an active-minded consumer, and I go, active-minded consumer. Not much of a wordsmith today, soz. But I kind of engage with it in my own way. I think that's allowed. The content's there. I'll download an episode or something. I've been listening to the Cracked.com podcast a lot recently. That's got some brilliant stuff on it. And also some charmingly American stuff that I just have no interest in at all. But I listen to it in my own way. So I think you have the right, don't you, as a listener, to go, okay, let's have a bit of this, and maybe I'll hang around. Maybe I should do sort of. Do you remember what Adam and Joe used to do with Black Squadron, where you were only Black Squadron if you actually listened to the show when it went out live, and then there was the Pod Squad as well. What I should do is a reverse version of that, whereby I keep spieling at the end of the episodes, and that way you can listen to it if you want. Because it strikes me as I quite enjoyed sitting in my car that time a couple of weeks ago, and just looking out into the darkness and having my little moment about impending fatherhood. And I do quite relish the opportunity to wander around my office, as I'm now doing, talking to you, just sort of talking. I mean, I wouldn't dream of saying no one. You're clearly still there. I mean, although to be fair, all of you might have switched off, and there is no way for me to tell. So I think maybe in future, maybe I'll just take this opportunity to let people turn off who just want the show, who just want the interview, and then let you just keep listening if you want to sort of listen to an additional 5 minutes of waffle at the end. Yeah, I mean, that's me. Well, talk about the creative process, guys. Just had an idea live on the podcast. Hey, I just by saying guys in that tone of voice, I've reminded myself, of course, of Joel Dommett and lovely Steve Dunn. They do their podcast called The Comedy Score, and I did an episode with them. It's such a great idea. It's an interview about your three favourite albums of all time, and then the guest tells a story, in this case me. You tell a story, and then brilliant, talented composer Steve Dunn scores it and creates some original music, and then overlays that on the edited into the story as it goes out. I listened back to my episode. I was absolutely howling with laughter in the car, mostly at them and the first Joel problems that someone like Joel Dommett encounters. So have a go at that. But yeah, I think I've sort of not prepared anything to talk to you about, but I do quite like the idea of just letting it run on at the end. And then I feel a bit less pressure to keep everything all tight and snappy. Which, I mean, we know how badly that works anyway. And it means I can just have a little bit of a ramble. I think that the show sounds, I don't know, to call it the show, I'm looking at it now on the wall. Baby, Jealous, Shark. The Shark bit's good. But sharks are hack, aren't they? Can I say anything new about sharks that hasn't been said? Not that I'm desperately, and you understand me. It's not like, oh my God, I've got to get the shark stuff out. I heard a funny fact about sharks, specifically baby sharks, that I think fits into a part of my show, but it's such a morass at the moment. It's such a soup of, like, I can tell you now, the Airbnb bit is good. It's current. It's relevant. It is a little bit at the moment, and this is something I often find. It's a little bit like, this is like part of my process. I've got to go through the bit where it's just a bunch of ideas for things to do. I think of it as like things to make and do. So there's the basic idea of going to an Airbnb being mostly, partly it's a holiday, but mostly it's an opportunity to spy on someone else's life, right? That's the observation. And then the additional material around that at the moment is fun things to do when you're in someone else's home under an Airbnb kind of, holiday thing. And I sort of would rather there were more observations and fewer things to make and do. Do you see what I mean? So I feel like I've got to push through that section. Not that section exactly. I did it last night at a gig in, where were we? Reading Uni. Bobby Mayer was there, and I gave him a lift to the station afterwards. Bobby Mayer is a funny, funny man. And he said, oh, that Airbnb, you can tell it's going to get somewhere. It's going to be like a big cornerstone bit. And I hope he's right. But I tried to pull it apart this morning, and I just find that I just can't see the wood for the trees. So it's probably as well, I think, by having this big spurt of work in November and December, hopefully I've ended up with enough stuff there that I can then take a break, have my little kind of mental 3 or 4 weeks of paternity leave,
and come back to it and go, oh, these are all the problems that thing had. I do that after every Edinburgh. After Edinburgh, I reappraise the show I was doing and I go, oh, yeah, I should just take out that, and that. And it sort of boils down, it naturally reduces. So last year, the plan was to try and do the show that I was going to do in October, the version of the Edinburgh show that it would turn into in October, to try and do that in August. I think that's a good plan. So I'm sort of trying to get my head around that again. The bit about locusts is good, man. It's a good locust bit coming up. That'll do. That'll do for now. This is just me toying with the idea. Should we leave this in, Nathan? Yeah, leave it in. Speak to you soon.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.